The Sunstone Foundation presents Money Diggersville, the brief turbulent history of the Mormon town of Warren. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Marshall Hamilton tells me that he's from Middletown, Maryland. He's in the publishing business, and he also works with a newsletter back in Maryland entitled Cardiac Arrest. And I would say to Marshall, I may have cardiac arrest before this introduction is over. We'll try to get through that without. He has been researching Mormon history for 2 years, and he has written 4 papers, which have been published, and this particular paper, as I understand it, will be published sometime during the year in an RLDS historical magazine. He's a BYU graduate in Latin American studies. He has 4 children, and he is a gospel doctrine teacher. So he's going to give us the gospel this afternoon according to Nauvoo history. The commentator with us today is also a graduate of BYU. She is an assistant professor at BYU and has a PhD from the University of Chicago. We, I think, are in for a treat, and without further ado, I will turn this program over to Marshall Hamilton. Marshall?
Thank you. The newsletter that I am publisher of is actually called Cardiac Alert. It's designed to prevent cardiac arrests, but...
You can see where my mind goes.
Well, during the Nauvoo period, one of Joseph Smith's frequent lawyers was Calvin A. Warren of the Quincy, Illinois firm of Ralston, Warren, and Wheat. Warren represented Joseph the Prophet as a defendant on several occasions, and perhaps his most notable representation of Joseph was in the Prophet's April 1842 bankruptcy proceeding. But the Prophet's first recorded meeting with Warren was not as a client, but as a defendant. Warren sat as Master in Chancery for Adams County, where Quincy is located. A Master of Chancery is a sort of court commissioner who, among other duties, assesses criminal charges and sets the amount of bail previous to a defendant's appearing before a judge for a full hearing. The Prophet was brought before Warren by the Adams County Sheriff, Thomas King. The principal charge against Joseph was treason against the state of Missouri. That was the same charge that 2.5 years before had led to his incarceration with 5 others in the Liberty Jail during the winter of 1838 and 39. For a time after they arrived in Illinois, the Mormon immigrants had hopes that the state of Missouri would let sleeping dogs lie and would not try to press the still unresolved treason charge now that the Mormons were safely out of the state. In fact, many Mormons, including the writer of the history of the church, insisted that Missouri had no claim since Smith's jailers more or less encouraged his escape. Of course, his escape under whatever circumstances would not constitute an adjudication of the charges. So the beliefs that the Mormons had that the case had been resolved were based more on their wishes than on substance. And after they arrived in Nauvoo, dark clouds began to gather early on. As early as September of 1840, 17 months after the escape, Governor Boggs of Missouri had made a requisition of the governor of Illinois for the arrest and extradition of the Prophet and his 5 companions. And the governor, following procedure, issued an arrest warrant, but the officer who tried to serve the warrant in Nauvoo was unable to find the Prophet and his 5 brethren at home. And for 9 months after that, there was no further attempt to enforce this warrant. So the Mormons convinced themselves that the issue would be dropped. But in June 1841, coincidentally, just after anti-Mormon editorials had first begun to appear in the Illinois press, the Prophet was indeed served with this arrest warrant. At the time of his arrest, Smith was in Bear Creek, Illinois, en route home from Quincy to Nauvoo. At Quincy, the prophet had seen his brother Hiram and another missionary off on a mission to the eastern states. And Joseph undoubtedly felt a degree of invincibility at this point. After all, despite the arrest warrant that was pending against him, Nauvoo had received a liberal city charter from the Illinois legislature, and Joseph himself had been commissioned lieutenant general of the Nauvoo Legion. Joseph went to Quincy and called on Governor Carlin, apparently oblivious to the fact that an unexecuted warrant still existed, and that Carlin was sworn as the state's chief executive to execute that warrant. Carlin treated the prophet with respect and never mentioned the pending legal action, but within hours after his departure from the governor's city, Joseph Smith was arrested by Carlin's subordinate, Sheriff King, who came with a posse, including an agent of the state of Missouri, to intercept Joseph's party on the road and to place the prophet under arrest. Along with the capital charges of treason against Missouri were the less serious charges of arson, burglary, robbery, and larceny. And also, since the six prisoners had escaped custody, there was an additional charge of being a fugitive from justice. Well, the prophet could not be spirited away to Missouri without a hearing, so that process began with his appearance before Master in Chancery Warren. At that appearance, apparently on his own behalf, Smith asked for and obtained a writ of habeas corpus, returnable before Judge Stephen A. Douglas, the circuit judge who was, of course, later to become famous for his debates with Abraham Lincoln. Douglas set the hearing on the writ for Tuesday, June 8th, 3 days later, in the town of Monmouth, Illinois, about 100 miles north of Quincy. Nauvoo lay along the road to Monmouth, and so Joseph Smith, still in custody, went to his own house that night in company with two officers, spent the night there, and then set out the next morning on the arduous trip to Monmouth. They arrived on Tuesday morning and found the circuit court in full swing, with the circuit riding judge and a party of circuit riding attorneys who traveled from county seat to county seat through the prairies of Illinois. Joseph Smith engaged six of the circuit riding attorneys for his defense, including Calvin Warren, who in his law practice, as opposed to his duties as Master in Chancery, in his law practice he often served as a defense counsel in the circuit court. Interestingly, of the six lawyers that Joseph hired for this hearing, four of them were involved 4 years later at the trial of the accused assassins of Joseph Smith, three of the four, including Calvin Warren, on the side of the defense, and one as the prosecuting attorney. Warren's role in this hearing for Joseph Smith was slight, but he was the lead defense attorney. He read the petition and outlined the defense, which was that the Missouri indictments had been illegally obtained and should therefore not be honored in Illinois. The star of the defense team was Orville H. Browning from Quincy, who had witnessed the bedraggled arrival of the Mormons as they came across the Mississippi River from Missouri. His moving speech described the brutality of the Missourians, which led to bloody footmarks in the snow from the persecuted women and children. It was reported that most of the spectators and court officers, including Judge Douglas himself, were moved to tears by the recitation. Later, the anti-Mormon newspaper editor Thomas Sharp would sneer, "Were there any onions about?" Whatever the merits of the defense's case or oratory, Douglas found that the warrant on which the prophet was held was illegal, since it had been returned to the governor with the sheriff's signature after the initial attempt to arrest the prophet 9 months earlier. Douglas dodged the conflict of laws question of whether Illinois courts were competent to judge the sufficiency of a Missouri indictment, saying that there was no need to rule on that question since the illegality of the writ was clear simply on the sheriff's initial return of the warrant to the governor. So the immediate problem, Smith's arrest, was solved, but the underlying cause, the Missouri indictments, still hung over the Mormons' head, and those indictments came back to haunt the Mormons practically every summer during their stay in Nauvoo. Well, Calvin Warren was a smart man, and he saw the potential for profit in his association with the Mormon leader. Before he had moved to Quincy, his law practice had been located in Warsaw, Illinois, and he still had many business associations there, just 12 miles south of Nauvoo. Among the opportunities for profit that Warren contemplated was the sale of a tract of land that he owned in partnership with several other people to the Mormons. He wanted to sell this tract of land to the Mormons for their expansion. At this time, expansion was a serious concern of the saints, for the prophet had issued two proclamations, one in January and another in May of 1841, calling on members of the church throughout the world to come immediately to Hancock County. The prophet had said, "This is important and should be attended to by all who feel an interest in the prosperity of this cornerstone of Zion." As a result, faithful Mormons from the eastern states and from the British Isles were making preparations to gather to Nauvoo. The number of immigrants joining with the saints in Nauvoo was a source of wonder and concern among the non-Mormon settlers in the area. One reason the numbers were so large was that Mormon missionaries in England were enjoying unprecedented success among the working classes and were encouraging their converts to emigrate. Until April of 1841, 8 members of the Council of the Twelve had been laboring as missionaries in England, and converts quickly numbered up into the thousands. Despite the difficulty of making the decision to leave behind family members and homeland, many of the new converts did just that. The missionaries were helpful in chartering ships to carry the emigrants to New Orleans, from which place they could take river passage to Nauvoo. Because of the large numbers of emigrants and the experience of the Mormon booking agents, the cost of the ocean passage was as low as £3.15. All told, the church agents estimated that all provisions and passage for the trip would run no more than £5 per person. At those prices, finances were only a small obstacle to emigration. But the church needed to find places to settle for thousands of new immigrants. Nauvoo had space for urban dwellers, but church leaders saw a need for wooded rural territory where some of the new immigrants might settle to feed themselves by working the land. The prophet was indeed interested when Calvin Warren suggested that the church purchase just such a tract of land adjoining the town of Warsaw. Well, under the terms of the Northwest Ordinance, which had created the Northwest Territory, including Illinois, in 1787, the land was divided into townships of 6 miles square. Of the 36 sections, or 1 mile square tracts, in each township, one section was to be designated the school section, the proceeds from the sale of which were to endow the public education of the children in the township. And this provision was mostly inadequate for funding schools on an ongoing basis, but it was the first admission of the federal government of the importance of universal education. The town of Warsaw occupied parts of two sections of its township, and residents of the town were proud of the endowment from the sale of their township's school section. That sale, for a price of a little over $17,000, brought the township the sum of a little over $2,000 per year. In 1840, when Warsaw boasted of about 800 residents, the town fathers calculated that that endowment was enough to educate up to 4 times the number of students who were then in residence. Warsaw, at the time of the Mormon settlement of Nauvoo, was the principal business town of Hancock County. Carthage, a few miles inland, was the county seat, but Warsaw claimed for itself all the commercial advantages. Warsaw occupied an important position on the Mississippi River, just opposite the mouth of the Des Moines River. The swirling waters of the Des Moines River's mouth caused rapids just opposite Warsaw, which made navigating the Mississippi at that point a difficult task. Most months of the year, boat captains were obliged to offload their cargo and arrange for overland transportation around the rapids, and then to tow their boats, their empty boats, over the rapids using team power. Because of the difficulty and expense of traversing the rapids, Warsaw was the effective northern terminus of Mississippi River traffic during much of each year. As settlement of the Upper Mississippi Territory continued, Warsaw saw prospect for much more business in years to come. And the Warsaw settlers lost few opportunities to congratulate themselves on the fine prospects of their town. It was the civic pride which led many Warsaw residents to object to the growth of Nauvoo initially. Until the coming of the Mormons, Nauvoo was known as Commerce, but as you know, precious little commerce was transacted there. It was an uncomfortable, sickly, swampy place, and contained, when Joseph Smith first saw the town, 1 stone house, 3 frame houses, and 2 block houses. For Warsaw's 800 proud residents to see a town grow from swampland to a population of over 10,000 in less than 3 years, it was a pretty bitter pill to take. As a result, many Warsaw were hopeful that their town, some Warsaw residents were hopeful that their town might share in the astonishing growth that the Mormons were bringing to their county. One group of citizens with that point of view included Calvin Warren, Mark Aldridge, a town father of Warsaw and one of the original developers, of the town, and Daniel Witter, who ran the flour mill there. They were the owners of the school section. The prophet's journal records that Witter had begun promoting the school section as a site for Mormon settlement since the earliest days of Nauvoo. But Calvin Warren didn't enter the negotiations until after the court appearance where he represented the prophet. Once Warren met the prophet, though, he became actively involved in the negotiations, and he found the Mormon leaders receptive to the plan. According to Thomas Ford, who later became Illinois governor and still later wrote a history of the state, Smith, after the hearing before Judge Douglas, was not lawyer enough to know whether the decision to release him was due to the merits of the case or to favoritism by the judge who was involved. In Ford's estimation, Smith was therefore the more inclined to esteem his discharge as a great favor. It's possible that Warren shared that feeling and decided to begin the serious negotiations while the prophet was still grateful for his legal assistance. By the middle of July, negotiations were well underway. The fiery newspaper editor, Sharp, mentioned that the transaction was to be a straight sale of the school section to the Mormons. Sharp's reaction was, "We sincerely hope that this curse will be spared us." Despite Sharp's opposition, the negotiations continued, and the deal was concluded at a meeting in Warsaw held on July 19th or July 20th. Sharp reported that Joseph Smith and John Bennett, who at the time was an assistant president of the church and mayor of Nauvoo, the two of them came to Warsaw and produced quite a sensation. The prophet was said to be a perfect curiosity. Sharp lamented that the deal had already been struck and there was no point in opposing it. He moaned, "The decree has gone forth for a Mormon city on our immediate borders," referring to persistent anti-Mormon claims of thievery by the Mormons. Sharp couldn't resist one more jab based on the economic principle of supply and demand. He said, "We have not heard whether locks have yet riz." As part of the transaction to buy the land, the school section was surveyed and laid out in town plots before the middle of August. Brigham Young, Heber Kimball, and Willard Richards, representing the Council of the Twelve, spent a day in Warren approving the town layout. Like Calvin Warren, Thomas Sharp was trained as a lawyer, but Sharp had found that a hearing loss prevented him from participating effectively in court. As a result, for several years he dabbled in journalism. When he first moved to Warsaw, he bought a paper called The Western World, which had been established 6 months before. As editor, he initially maintained a neutral or faintly positive stance toward the Mormons, despite their growth, which threatened the primacy of the town of Warsaw. After 6 months of editing The Western World in May of 1841, Sharp changed the name of the paper to the better-known Warsaw Signal. He said that the title Western World was too extensive in its signification. The Warsaw Signal was, in his judgment, appropriate and neat and limited in its meaning to the sphere of its action. About the same time as this name change, the paper's attitude toward the Mormons also underwent a major shift. Sharp published two articles mildly critical of church leader John Bennett and of conditions in Nauvoo for immigrants. Those articles provoked a swift, angry reaction from the church, including a letter from the prophet calling the Signal a tissue of lies and a sink of iniquity. They didn't have PCDs in those days. From that point on, the battle between Joseph Smith and Thomas Sharp was joined. Sharp attacked the church in print at every possible opportunity. A transcript of the articles relating to Mormonism in the 6 months before the breach occupies just 17 pages. A similar transcript for the 6 months after the break takes up no less than 146 pages. Most of the Signal's negative comments about the Mormons during this period concern the political clout of the Mormons. During the first 2 months after the antagonism broke out, Sharp was instrumental in establishing the Anti-Mormon Party, a political group designed to field candidates for local election in opposition to the Mormons. Sharp's concern was that the two main parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, would pander to the Mormons in an effort to secure their vote. It was widely known that the Mormons tended to vote as a bloc, and in fact, the political parties were not bashful about seeking their vote. So Sharp frequently discussed political affairs and encouraged the old citizens to vote the anti-Mormon line. Sharp also dredged up potentially embarrassing items from the Mormons' 11-year history. He quoted from the court of inquiry that had been held in Missouri, which had led to the indictments under which Joseph Smith was arrested in June. And he also discussed the banking scandal which had interrupted the Mormons' stay in Kirtland, Ohio. He discussed the evidence that the Mormons had formed a group called the Danites during the Missouri period to drive from Missouri communities any dissenters or anti-Mormons. And he criticized what he perceived as militarism among the Mormons with their Nauvoo Legion. Along with these items of what we might consider today to be fair comment, Sharp also developed a taste for ad hominem slurs against the prophet himself. On July 14, 1841, Sharp published a narrative provided by the Reverend John Clark, who had preached in Palmyra, New York, during the 1820s before the church was founded. Clark alleged that the Smith family was made up of shiftless vagrants, who supported themselves mainly by money digging, a process by which clairvoyants would be inspired to seek for treasure in certain spots. Such mystics would, according to Clark, support themselves by duping the unwary into financing digging expeditions. Sharp enthusiastically picked up on the allegations of money digging. After the initial allegation on July 14th, he repeated the money digging aspersion in each of the next two weekly issues, on July 21st and July 28th. In his next issue, of August 4th, Sharp connected the money digging claim with the forthcoming new settlement and allowed his wit to run rampant. He said, "We have not yet heard what name Joe intends to give to the new city, but we have a first-rate one in our mind's eye, which we will suggest, believing it to be highly appropriate. We would call it Money Diggersville. Quite a mouthful, but still symphonious. Now, we think this will be just the thing exactly, because it will forever remain a striking memento of the glorious and dignified origin of our modern race of prophets. What do you say, Joe? Money Diggersville. Why, there is not another town of that name in the Union, nor in the whole world. And you know rarity is a great charm." Still quoting from Sharp, "As to the prospects of this new city, which we shall call Money Diggersville, believing that Joe cannot withstand our arguments in favor of the adoption of that name, they are said to be very flattering so far as numbers are concerned. It is said that about 70 wagons loaded with red-hot Mormons just from the state of New York are on their way to Nauvoo. Probably they have arrived before this. Rumor says that Joe designs to send a part of these down this way to make a commencement. We intend to mark the day of the first arrival as one important era in the history of our town." And referring again to the charges of thievery, Sharp goes on, "We will also note the night on which the first porker disappears as another important era." Sharp was undoubtedly disappointed 3 weeks later when it was announced that the prophet had decided to name the new settlement Warren after his lawyer and one of the sellers in the transaction. Thomas Sharp mused in his paper, "Friend Warren, your chance for immortality is now certain. We still think, however, that the name we suggested, Money Diggersville, would be more appropriate, as it is certainly a more euphonious appellation." Well, scarcely had the Saints completed their purchase of the Warsaw School section upon the most liberal terms, they were not obliged to pay the principal until the land had been subdivided and sold in smaller lots to new immigrants. No sooner had they completed the deal than the church leaders were able to use the new purchase as leverage in exerting better terms from the sellers of the land on which Nauvoo itself stood. When the sellers of Nauvoo requested some payment of the principal due them, Joseph wrote to them explaining that this new purchase, Warren, had alleviated the Mormons' need for land, and he suggested that if the sellers of Nauvoo were dissatisfied with the church's payment history, which was dismal, the sellers were welcome to come and reclaim the land. It seems that this offer was a bluff, because there's no other indication anywhere that the saints considered leaving Nauvoo. As the gathering of the saints continued into the fall of 1841, the apostles encouraged the saints scattered abroad among the nations to look at Warsaw. In a letter, the 12 suggested that every facility is now offered to the brethren for the immediate erection of houses, the location being very desirable at the lowest point of the Des Moines Rapids. And they assured newcomers that one or more of our quorum may be found at Nauvoo, Zarahemla, which was the church name for Montrose in Iowa Territory across the river, and at Warren, ready to render every assistance towards the location of immigrants. The 12 later designated Willard Richards to stay at Warren to take charge of real estate matters and any other business. As October passed, the leaders of the church found themselves in financial difficulties. An agent of the church, Isaac Galland, had apparently absconded with money intended to be used to pay interest on the purchase of town land in Nauvoo. Although the brethren intended to complete the settlement of Warren, by this time they seemed to be backing off a little from their enthusiasm. They mentioned, for example, how important it was that immigrants move to Nauvoo so as to be able to work on the temple. Still, in a November 15th letter, the 12, after discussing the importance of the Nauvoo temple, reiterated their earlier recommendation of Warren as a place to settle. In mid-November, Warren was finally settled by a party of 204 English saints under the direction of Joseph Fielding, who had returned from his mission on the same vessel with them. Apostles Willard Richards and John Taylor went to Warren before the end of November to encourage the British saints, who were a little unnerved by the continuing blasts from Thomas Sharp and by the activities of the anti-Mormon party in Warsaw. Thomas Sharp himself was of two minds about the new settlers once he got to know them. He candidly admitted in his paper that it had been his feeling that none but knaves or fools could be followers of Joseph Smith, but he professed his astonishment that these English were intelligent, well-informed, and apparently very strong in the faith. Further, it was Sharp's opinion that the general appearance of the whole body is far more favorable than the same number of foreign immigrants usually present. However, not all was well with the Warren settlers. Daniel Witter, one of the sellers of the property, began gouging the new settlers by raising his flour price by $1 a barrel, even mixing in mill sweepings with the flour. In addition, Witter and Mark Aldrich, apparently with an eye to keeping their investment intact should the Mormons not complete their purchase, forbade the settlers from clearing the land of timber. Without that source of income, the settlement of Warren seemed much less economically sound. On December 13th, the First Presidency decided that all saints at Warren should abandon the place and move to Nauvoo. This was the second contraction in the Mormons' borders in Hancock County in less than 9 days, and signaled what we might consider a major shift in the church's gathering policy. Earlier, the stake in the Mormon town of Ramus — Ramus is Latin for branch, and the town was named that because it was a branch of the church from Nauvoo — the stake at Ramus had been discontinued, at least partly because of thieves who had taken refuge among the saints at Ramus, lending credibility to anti-Mormon claims of rampant thievery by church members. From that point on, recommendations to gather centered on Nauvoo as a place of destination and not the outlying towns. There were very few references at all to the outlying towns, and there were no references at all to the town of Warren. The last comments in Joseph Smith's journal about Warren indicate that Calvin Warren, along with Witter and Aldrich, came to Nauvoo to plead poverty, since it appeared that the land transaction would not be completed. According to Smith's journal, once church leaders explained to them the difficulties of settling in Warren, the land speculators retired, manifesting the best of feeling and expressing the most perfect satisfaction with their visit, with me and all concerned. Despite that, within 3 months, both Aldrich and Warren declared bankruptcy, leading some scholars to suspect that the failed land deal led directly to their bankruptcy proceedings, although it's possible that there's some connection. In fact, neither Aldrich nor Warren was really damaged in the bankruptcy. Under the terms of the nation's first bankruptcy law, which had only recently been enacted, they were able to transfer their property to straw men, then reacquire their property after the declaration of bankruptcy for pennies on the dollar. Under those terms, only the creditors were the losers, not the debtors. Bankruptcy became so prevalent about that time that Joseph Smith himself, with Calvin Warren as his attorney, filed for bankruptcy in mid-April of 1842. Joseph's discharge in bankruptcy never occurred because some of the creditors objected, and before the court had a chance to rule on the final discharge of his debt, Smith was assassinated. But under the circumstances, despite what many historians have said, it appears to me that the failure of the Warren settlement contributed little, if at all, to anti-Mormon settlement, because it really did very little to harm the financial interests of the non-Mormons. So we see in the town of Warren that the church members tried to make a settlement really in the very midst of their most bitter local enemies, and the settlement failed within just a few weeks. After that, church leaders contented themselves with less grandiose plans for expansion. recommending that the Saints come to Nauvoo itself, and no longer predicting a string of Mormon settlements throughout the neighboring prairies. In a sense, the settlement of Warren was the high watermark of Nauvoo, of Mormon expansionist plans in Illinois. As the proposed town named Money Diggersville points out, attempts to spread out into outlying areas aroused bitter, vicious persecution, contention which made successful expansion next to impossible, and which, of course, did not really abate until after the assassination of Joseph Smith.
Marshall Hamilton has given us an interesting piece of social and community history, exploring a little-known subject, the background of the founding of the town of Warren, Illinois, and reminding us that during the Nauvoo period, not all Mormons lived in Nauvoo itself. His clear and straightforward style makes the paper easy reading. Further, he has obviously mastered the extant files of the Warsaw Signal, transcribing 163 double-spaced typed pages of articles from that newspaper, which he uses as the major primary source for his paper. I do, however, have some concerns. Reading through the paper, I was overwhelmed by the amount of background information Mr. Hamilton provides. More often, historians are accused of sliding the context, but in this case, the history of Warren is buried under too much context. How germane, really, is an extended discussion of 5 pages of Joseph Smith's extradition hearing and trial to the history of the community of Warren. When one systematically slices away this and other such padding, one is left essentially with much the same information about Warren that Oaks and Hill summarize in 2 paragraphs. I cannot see that Mr. Hamilton has added significantly to our understanding of the community by looking at such questions that most community historians ask, such as, who were the 204 English saints asked to colonize Warren? Upon what basis were they chosen? From what classes did they come? What occupations did they represent? Does there seem to have been any attempt to recruit a variety of trades and professions in addition to the farmers to ensure the viability of the community? Who were the community leaders? How were they chosen? How was land acquired? From Mr. Hamilton's brief description, I am led to believe that the entire scheme was rather haphazard and ill-conceived and probably would have failed on its own. But until we have the answers to at least some of these questions, we will never know for certain. According to Mr. Hamilton's research, the town of Warren lasted for only 1 month. Just how significant was it to Mormon history? If its significance lies in its role in discouraging the church from making additional settlements outside Nauvoo, why not then discuss it in the context of these other settlements of Montrose and Ramus and thus sharpen the focus of the paper? I have a few other specific concerns. When Mr. Hamilton speaks of Stephen A. Douglas's, quote, losing political battles with Abraham Lincoln, we must remember that Douglas was the winner in the 1858 Illinois senatorial race against Lincoln. But we remember, I think, more often his losing effort in the 1860 presidential race. I would also like more information on the reaction of the residents of Warsaw, who had objected to the growth of Nauvoo, to Warren and his company selling land to Mormons so close outside their town. Were there any opponents other than Thomas Sharp? And what other than Thomas Sharp's editorials and the seller's shady business practices constitute, quote, the bitter, vicious persecution, end quote, that Mr. Hamilton finds at the root of the reason for the Saints abandoning Warren? Also, no mention is made of Aldrich's and Warren's later dealings. Mark Aldrich was tried, along with 8 others, for the murders of Joseph and Hiram Smith. Calvin Warren was one of the defense attorneys. His defense was characterized by his particularly vituperative attacks against the Mormons. Oaks and Hill attribute these men's bitter hatred of the church to their failures in the land transaction and subsequent bankruptcy. Thus, the history of Warren takes on added significance to Mormon history when we see what happened to men who were involved in the transaction. I applaud Mr. Hamilton for his work and his interest in this area and in illuminating the history of this very obscure yet important community to Mormon history. Thank you.
This has been a most enlightening discussion of a unique phase of American history. I found it fascinating. I wonder if you would entertain questions.
Sure.
For a few moments. Let's turn this over to questions for just a few moments, all right?
Apparently there were some really rough cabins, but nothing that was intended to be permanent. Yes?
How far was Warren from Nauvoo?
I did. Warren was about 12 miles south of Nauvoo, just outside the town of Warsaw.
Was it better property? It wasn't swampland?
It was not swampland. It probably was. It was more healthful than commerce was. I don't know. I've been there. It's probably more than 1 square mile in area. The temple to Joseph Smith's home is probably about a mile, and there was more to the town than that. So, probably a little bit bigger than Warren would have been in area. Yes. Bankruptcy, but the bankruptcy proceeding was never completed.
It made it so that the properties were gone from bankruptcy, and then they said that it could be picked up.
Under the terms of the bankruptcy law, most debtors, most bankrupts would, and I shouldn't say most. Most of the ones that I've read about who declared bankruptcy under this law made it a practice to deed their property to friends and then reacquire it after the discharge for pennies on the dollar. And there were so many problems with the federal bankruptcy law that it was repealed within 2 years. No, I'm not making that suggestion. The point that I was making with regard to the bankruptcy of the sellers of the land was that despite what Marvin Hill and several other scholars have written, it's my view that the sellers of the land were not harmed financially in this transaction. Warren Jennings is another scholar who has made that point, and that's a point of departure from them. There's an interesting article that Dallin Oaks, I think, wrote on the bankruptcy proceeding. Is that right? In University of Utah Law Review, in the early 70s, about 73. I'd refer you to that for further reading. I'm not an expert on Joseph's bankruptcy proceeding. The article is titled "In the Wake of the Steamboat Nauvoo," and talks a great deal about his bankruptcy proceeding. So I'd refer you to that. Any other questions?
Yes, I have a question. I have a question for Mary. Why do you think it would have been important in the paper to indicate the social standing of the saints coming from the British Isles?
One of the things that community historians do is to try and analyze the social structure of a community. Who moves into a community? How is that community structured? Who are the leaders of the community? Who controls access to politics? Who controls access to land? How are these things apportioned? And one of the other things that you look at, too, when you have a planned community is to see exactly, is the community structured well enough so that it can exist on its own? If this were a true community other than simply a collection of farms, and I'm not clear exactly what was the philosophical base behind this, and in fact there may not have been a philosophical base behind it at all. I get the feeling that Joseph was being pressured on all sides by various factions, and this was one way of alleviating some pressure, was getting another place for people to settle, and that it was not particularly well conceived. But if there was hope for this particular settlement existing in the long run, then you needed to make sure that you had a balance of trades there, that you could form a cohesive community that was going to be fairly economically self-sufficient. And so I think it's important to see what the background of these people are, what do they bring to the community, and what were the long-term chances of it surviving on its own. I would almost argue that the community may have failed on its own even without the anti-Mormon pressure.
I have one more question for Marshall. Maybe I misunderstood you, but I thought you said that this particular city, and I quote, was a high water mark of Mormon expansion. Would you clarify what you meant by that just a shade?
Sure. When the Mormons first settled commerce, they established communities in many other settlements, some of which I've mentioned, Montrose, Iowa, others I haven't mentioned, including Fountain Green, Lima in Adams County, and many other places throughout Hancock County. One scholar has even said that there were Mormon communities wedged into every possible spot in Hancock County. Well, having been to Hancock County, it's very flat. It's hard to imagine that they were wedged into every possible spot. But, I mean, it's difficult to tell what prompted people to settle on any given tract of land because there are very few physical features saying, here's where we need to be. But the Mormons originally, as I said, established communities throughout Hancock County and south into Adams County. They were very enthusiastic in the early going about the potential for success in all of those communities as well as in Nauvoo. And as I mentioned, there was a stake organization at the town of Ramos, and in several of the other communities there were ecclesiastical organizations. After the demise of the community of Warren, pronouncements of the leaders of the church were much less enthusiastic about the prospects for success in other communities. The calls to gather were to gather to Nauvoo, to come there because the temple needed hands to work. In other words, the church leaders had little interest, really, in having immigrants move elsewhere than to the city of Nauvoo proper. And the reason I call it a high water mark is that it's simply the sort of the broadest manifestation of their expansionist point of view. From then on, until the death of the Smiths, the Mormons were contracting into the city of Nauvoo itself.
Do we have some other questions?
That's really hard to say. Estimates vary from about 10,000 to 15,000 to 17,000. I don't recall seeing any reasonably accurate estimates greater than about 17,000. Are you aware of any, Mary?
No, I've heard around 11.
It's really difficult to say. I've looked at the number of votes that were cast in elections in Nauvoo, but since only adult males were allowed to vote, it's really hard to generalize from that. Hancock County was, without any question, the largest county in the state. We've all heard that Nauvoo was bigger than Chicago. It was. By any measure, Nauvoo was bigger than, or Hancock County was bigger than Cook County in those days.
Any others? Let's don't let these experts get away without questions. Yes.
And was Nauvoo considered?
The Mormons were quite successful at draining the swamps. John Bennett helped with that process. They made it much, much more healthful. They called it the City Beautiful. The city was pretty primitive. To have thousands of people jammed into a little area without our standards of modern plumbing and so forth, we might argue with how beautiful the town was. There were problems there, and there was disease there throughout the Mormons' stay, despite the success that they had. So I would say that certainly parts of the city were beautiful, but many of the streets were never paved. Many of the houses had outbuildings by, you know, many outbuildings, and the conditions were not terribly healthful during the Mormon stay there. The temple itself was, I'm certain, a beautiful location, situated as it was on the top of a hill, commanding a wide view of the Mississippi River, and it was enclosed by a wall. But many of the residential areas of the city, I believe, were pretty unhealthful and probably not very aesthetically appealing. He defended them as a lawyer. Oaks and Hill, and if I could take issue with Mary's comment a moment, Oaks and Hill have cited Warren's defense of the killers of the prophet as an example of Warren's anti-Mormon activities. They called him, in this context, I can't remember the wording, but they called him a leader of the anti-Mormons. I disagree that the fact that he defended them in court meant that he was a leader of the anti-Mormons. He was not involved, in my research, in the anti-Mormon community meetings that had been held. I don't believe he was involved in the mob. He was, as most lawyers are today, they were then, a hired gun and you know, willing to take a anyone as a client. And so I don't believe that he was a leader of anti-Mormons. He defended the prophet just as readily as he defended the prophet's killers.
But you have to remember that Aldrich was tried.
Aldrich was a bad guy.
But Aldrich was one of the sellers of the land, too. Yes. He and Warren had been business partners. And then he was one of the men who was finally indicted and tried.
But, you know, I think it's important that we make a distinction that there were anti-Mormons who were actively involved in what we call the mob activities, and we fail to differentiate between the mobbers. You know, we say, you know, a bunch of mobocrats or a bunch of mobbers did this. Well, there were really a relative handful of people who were inciting the mob. That group included Aldrich, Thomas Sharp, Levi Williams, and several others who were the leaders of the anti-Mormon movement. And quite often, close associates would differ on how the Mormons should be treated. One example is Thomas Sharp, the publisher of the Warsaw Signal, for a time alternated ownership of the paper with a man named Thomas Gregg. Now, Gregg was a Quaker by birth and very pacifist in his mentality. He thought that the Mormons should leave too, but he was opposed to the anti-Mormons who insisted on driving the Mormons out. He showed his opposition several times during his association with Thomas Sharp. So even though they were closely associated, one was a mob leader and the other was an objector. So the fact that Aldrich was a bad guy doesn't, we shouldn't tar all Warren with the same brush.
How many years of peace did the Mormons have in Nauvoo?
Well, they had 2 years of peace, from the spring of 1839 till the spring of 1841. From the time the signal turned against the Mormons, there were anti-Mormon meetings held regularly throughout the county, and I would suggest that May of 1841 is the turning point, the time during which the Mormons no longer stopped having peace in their community.
Others? Well, I know that we appreciate the research, the careful research, and we certainly appreciate the critique of these people. Let's give them a hand. Thank you for coming.